The usual method is to obtain some object which is impregnated with the intended victim's magnetism, a lock of hair, nail, paring, or something habitually worn or handled. Such an object is magnetically connected with its owner, and the sorcerer can work up the trail and thus enter the sphere of his victim and establish a rapport. He then proceeds as does any other practitioner of suggestion who has succeeded in getting his victim into the first stages of hypnosis. By means of the magnetic link he has gained the psychic ear of his victim, who will hear his suggestions subconsciously. It now remains to be seen whether the thought, seeds thus planted will strike root or be cast out from the mind. In any case the victim is rendered disturbed and uneasy. If a magnetic link cannot be obtained, the practitioner of black magic has to fall back upon other devices. One of the most common is that of substitution. Something is chosen and by means of ceremonial is identified with the intended victim. For instance, a small animal may be baptized with the victim's name, and then immolated, usually with torture, the operator meanwhile concentrating upon the personality of the original. The old device of making a wax image and melting it before a fire, or driving nails into a wooden statue, baptized with the name of the victim, are frequently met with in the records of witch trials. The actual driving of the nail has no conceivable effect upon the victim, but it helps the concentration of the operator. The talismanic method in various forms is also employed. A talisman is a symbol representing a certain force, or combination of forces, depicted upon a suitable substance and magnetized by ritual. It can be made from anything which will retain magnetism. Metals, precious stones or parchment are usually employed. Paper is less effective unless it be enclosed in a metal case. Water and oil can be effectually magnetized but soon lose their potency. A talisman is made by invoking the requisite force, as already described, and then concentrating it upon the prepared object, which is placed ready upon the altar before the evocation begins. A talisman thus made has next to be brought into the magnetic sphere of the victim. It is related that Lady Burton, anxious to convert her free, thinking husband, the famous Sir Richard Burton, the great explorer, used to get her priest to bless little statues of the saints and put them in the pockets of his clothes. A similar device is used by the workers of black occultism. Objects are placed in the rooms habitually occupied by the victim, or buried in his path, so that he must pass over them frequently. These talismans of evil not only work by their own power, but also serve the sorcerer as a point of concentration for his meditations. Harmful effects are also produced by objects which have been used in black magic and have become impregnated with the forces they were employed in generating. Odds and ends of magical equipment turn up in some queer places. I was present at an auction in a country town when the 12 signs of the zodiac, neatly painted on a blackboard, came up for sale. Various of my friends have picked up magical treasures, such as altar lamps and incense burners that obviously came out of ritual lodges, but the prize of the collection was a magical rod that was put up to auction along with a bundle of fire irons. Large crystals for scrying are frequently seen in antique shops. All such things need carefully de-magnetizing before they are brought into one's psychic sphere. I was taking part at one time in a series of psychic experiments which had been going on very well, when, for no apparent reason, things went wrong and there was a considerable upheaval. We did not know at the time, but we learned later, that the owner of the flat where they were being held had obtained possession of a floor cloth that had been used in ritual magic by an occultist whom only the utmost leniency could call doubtful. The artificial elemental is really the basis of the efficacy of curses. In this case, no physical substance is employed, but a portion of the akasha is molded into a definite form and held thus by the will of the operator until, as it were, it sets. Into this mold is poured the concentrated energy of the operator. Something of his own self goes into it. This is its soul, and it is like a self-steering torpedo which is set to move in a curve towards a chosen mark. Or the operator, if an expert magician, may deliberately ensoul this thought, form with elemental essence, which is the raw, undifferentiated substance of life drawn from one or another of the elemental kingdoms. It is in order to do this that the curse is invoked in the name of some being. The cursor declares, "I curse you by so and so." This is the form of evocation which calls the ensouling essence into the thought, form, thus making an artificial elemental which is endowed with an independent life of its own. If we want to know something of the efficacy of curses, we have only to consider the record of the men who were connected with the opening of the famous Tut, Ankh, Amen tomb. There are many other cases equally well authenticated. One can become exposed to occult unpleasantness either by thwarting or in some other way falling foul of an unscrupulous occultist, or by getting oneself involved with a dubious occult fraternity. In the case of a quarrel with an occultist, in addition to the ordinary human motives for an abuse of power, one has to reckon with the fact that an adept who is not of the whitest nearly always suffers from that unpleasant psychic disease of hypertrophied ego. He will love power for its own sake, and take any defection on the part of an erstwhile follower, or any resistance to his imperious will as a personal insult or even injury. With a trained mind, an angry thought will do damage, and I have known cases of occultists who, out of pure pique, went to extraordinary lengths of spite. One can only hope that they did not really believe in the efficacy of what they did, and were merely playing to the gallery poor encourager lay orders and ensure loyalty among their supporters. Another thing which is particularly disliked by this type of adept is any attempt on the part of a pupil who has broken with him to make use of what he has been taught. There seem to be no lengths to which a jealous guru will not go in order to smash his keeler psychically. In one case which came to my knowledge, a concert singer had had treatment for the improvement of her voice from an adept of sorts. She finally decided that she would spend no more money on this enterprise, and told him so at the visit which she had decided should be the last. He concentrated his gaze upon her and told her that if she broke with him, as soon as she went on the concert platform she would see his face in the air in front of her, and her throat would close and she would be unable to utter a sound, and that this horrible experience would occur every time she tried to sing until she returned to him and continued to have treatment, at a guinea a time. This potent hypnotic suggestion proved effective, and her career was at an end until the spell was broken. The following letter contains a very illuminating experience, and is of value, not only for its account of a psychic attack, but also for its description of the manner in which the attack was combated. In the winter of 1921, too, I was told, "From the inner planes, we see your initiation into the Order of the Christ." I did not understand very clearly and I waited. In June, 1922, an Oriental, the head of a great religious order, came to see me. I was living in Switzerland, we will call him Zed. I expected great things from him and looked on him as a sort of master. Knowing that he had met Abdu'l-Bahá, I thought to please him by putting a B.S. photo on my walls, but when Zed entered my room I saw at once that he did not quite like it. We conversed for a while and he asked me several questions. Suddenly, he offered me initiation into his order. I was taken aback and did not feel the inner consent. I said I must reflect. Later on an inspiration came to me and I said, "Is your order the Order of the Christ?" He answered, "It is." I told him of my experience, related above, and accepted initiation, but I had the inner conviction that all was not right. I felt no inner response to several incidents during the initiation, and I began to call mentally and earnestly upon the Christ, and kept on doing so until the end of the ceremony. I learned afterwards that he had told one of his disciples that I had accepted initiation but not the master. It would take too long to relate other less important details, so I go on to our second interview, during which he asked me several times to leave the town where I was and to join him in active work. This time I heard the inner voice clearly. It said, "No." Suddenly he said, "Sit in front of me, I will heal you." I was in very bad health at the time. He fixed his eyes on mine with a strong commanding gaze. Mentally I called on the Christ and I felt form all round me a sort of shell. "There," he said, "I have healed you." The inner voice said, "No." "Well, He went away and I had a bad time, for I had the feeling that all was not right, though I had no suspicion of evil. Nor have I now. I wrote an account of this interview to a friend, and a letter from her crossed mine. She told me that about the time of my interview with Zed, of which she was unaware, she was told to join our spiritual teacher in helping me. She withdrew from the outer planes, and then she realized that strong hypnotic forces were playing upon me in waves. Again and again she had to use all her spiritual power to help me withstand them, but finally we stood on a rock, bathed in light and free. My letter gave her the key to it, but she replied, "Take care, Zed. We'll try again." That he was baffled, he will try on the inner planes next time. Now comes the great experience. A few weeks later, at night, I had a very vivid vision, it seemed, but it was a real experience. I was in the middle of a group of 7 or 8 persons of whom I saw 2 clearly. On my left was a woman entirely veiled in black, but she made a startlingly clear figure for all that. On the right was Zed. He said, "Now I will give her the second, the higher initiation," and he seized my right arm with force. But I disengaged myself, and standing straight and calm I said, "I can hear myself now. Before this ceremony proceeds I wish to make a statement. I can allow nothing and no one to come between me and the Christ." There was a howl, a tossing of hands and everything disappeared. Soon after I tore up my initiation card, put Zed out of my mind and have had no conscious personal experience of him since. But I had introduced him to a young French musician of high social standing, whom he found much to his taste. We will call him F. There is a close friendship between F and me, and at that time he needed some oriental music for one of his compositions. On the other hand, he might have been extremely useful to Zed, towards whom he felt strongly attracted. After my own experience I began to be much alarmed, but felt that I was not big enough to deal with the situation, so I said nothing to F, but prayed that he might be protected from all evil. Shortly afterwards F told me in his letters of various astral experiences. In his dreams he was going through all sorts of disagreeable things and voices kept saying to him, "Ask Zed to help you. He will help you." Then he became conscious of my presence and began calling on the Christ, all this in his dream, and everything vanished. This happened more than once. Only when I met him again did I tell him of my own experience. I must add that a friend with psychic power came to see me at this time and said, "This last week, at night, I have seen you 3 times. You asked me to help you save a young man who was in danger. What did it mean?" The above case indicates clearly the deliberate use of mental power by Zed, his pretense of spiritual healing being an obvious attempt at hypnosis. My correspondent says definitely that she has never suspected him of deliberate evil, rather was he acting rightly according to his lights. I maintain, however, that any attempt to dominate others, or in any way to manipulate their minds without their consent, is an unwarrantable intrusion upon their free will and a crime against the integrity of the soul. How can we judge the intimate spiritual needs of another, especially if that other has not elected to confide in us? What right have we to invade his spiritual privacy and thrust our tampering fingers into the wheels of his innermost being? It is so common a practice to send the names of people to healing circles with a request 64 of 103 that they should be concentrated upon, without taking the preliminary precaution of asking their permission, that I have heard it announced from the platform of a large spiritualist public meeting that only those cases could be taken up which gave their written consent. Fortunately for all concerned, the proceedings at such healing circles are usually so futile that nobody need mind being concentrated upon by them even if they were attempting murder. The principle, however, remains, and I can only record my opinion once more, as I have already recorded it many times, that such a proceeding is an outrageous breach of good manners and good faith, and contrary to all occult tradition. I think I can honestly say that I have never wished to direct the great currents of destruction upon my fellow occultists, but there are some of them I would like to get face downwards across my knee. Chapter 18. The motives of psychic attack. We have noted in a previous chapter that the simplest way to find out whether the victim of an alleged psychic attack is romancing or not, is to seek for motives, and if they are not discernible, to give imagination the benefit of the doubt. The commonplace motives of greed, lust, revenge and fear of betrayal do not need psychic discernment for their discovery but are perceptible to the naked eye. There are other motives, however, that may be operative in occult circles but which would be passed by unsuspected by the ordinary investigator. The old charm, books that have come down to us, mostly via the servants' hall, are replete with recipes for securing the love of the opposite sex. The ancient grimoires supply more elaborate ritual prescriptions, and the reports of witch trials contain frequent indictments of the wise woman who, for a consideration, undertook to direct people's affections towards persons for whom they apparently had no natural predilection. Are such operations to be taken seriously, or should we class them with the anti-fat pills that reduce without dieting? We have already referred to the old love filters. The ancients were well acquainted with the aphrodisiac drugs which excited sexual passion. Nor are the modems altogether ignorant of them, as carefully worded advertisements in certain occult publications reveal. There are firms in France which specialize in the manufacture of chocolates which contain masked doses of these drugs. Publicity was given to their productions recently owing to the death of two girls and a man through taking overdoses. There are cocktails in use in this country containing so-called tonic ingredients whose effect is well known. If these are not love filters, what are they? We are not concerned in these pages with methods that belong solely to the physical plane, but these matters call for mention because there are grounds for belief that upon more than one occasion, even in this country, aphrodisiacs have been employed as an adjuvant to occult practices. There was a certain firm which began to advertise extensively and was building up a nice business in what might be called occultist sundries. Among other preparations which they supplied was incense for the operation of Venus. However, the firm came to an untimely end through the intervention of the police, both partners going to jail. But apart from the use of purely material means, it is not difficult to see what uses could be made of mental influence in this direction. I have seen several cases that looked extremely suspicious, but in these matters it is very difficult to get at the facts. The manner of attack is intangible and leaves no trace, and the victim may be unsuspicious and entirely ignorant not only of the psychic side of sex, but also of its physical and subtler emotional aspects. Moreover, those who have suffered most usually talk least. One may occasionally hear of the attempt which was frustrated. The attempt, which was successful, very rarely comes to light because the victim has just as much motive for concealing it as the aggressor. When we come to purely occult practices, there are two ways in which the desired end can be achieved. Psychic pressure may be brought to bear upon the desired person so that he or she shall come under the influence of the operator, or the psychic operation known as congressus subtilis may take place. What exactly is congressus subtilis? We shall have to know a good deal more than we do at present about the occult side of sex before we can answer that question. In the first place, what are the facts, or alleged facts, of the matter? The ancients held very definite beliefs upon the subject, and these beliefs can very often afford us a clue, even if we do not accept the very anthropomorphic explanations by which they are accompanied. It was believed that the Demon Lilith had a very great deal to do with these matters. According to the Kabbalists, Lilith was the first wife of Adam, who used to visit him in his dreams while he was as yet alone in the Garden of Eden, and the Lord God became so perturbed at these goings on that he created Eve as a counter attraction. Witches were the recipients of similar attentions from the devil. St. Teresa of Avila records that the Godhead itself visited her. The Virgin Mary received the Holy Ghost. Saint Anthony was tempted by apparitions of beautiful female demons. There are many cases on record of whole nunneries being attacked by the devil, who visited their members. George Moore, in his exceedingly interesting study of convent life, Sister Teresa, gives an account of an outbreak of counterparts among the younger nuns, in which they formed liaisons with angelic lovers, who were supposed to be the souls of those who were drowned in the flood. We read in Genesis and in the Book of Enoch that the sons of God mated with the daughters of men, and the demonic race was the result. The folk lore of every country contains instances of the mating of humans with elementals, usually with disastrous consequences. Classical literature is full of stories of the visits of gods and goddesses to humankind. What shall we say of all such stories? Is there any element in them beyond fairy tale and wish fulfillment? We can readily understand the motive of the nun who, wishing to conceal the identity of her paramour, declares herself to be with child by the devil. We can equally understand the psychology of the rest of the convent that take up the story and see the devil in every corner. Let me cite certain cases which have come within my personal knowledge and see whether in the light of these we can sift fact from fantasy. There came to visit me once a young man who was in love with a married woman. He told me that upon several occasions he had had a very vivid dream of visiting her, and she had simultaneously dreamed of receiving his visit. He was anxious to perfect the technique of this operation, hence the visit to me. I am afraid I was unsympathetic, consequently I did not obtain any further information concerning this curious experiment. An even more curious case came to my knowledge some years ago. A woman told me that in the days of her youth she had been engaged to marry a man to whom she was very deeply attached, and who was murdered while working as a missionary in West Africa. Having lost the only man she felt she could love, she consented to marry a second cousin who had long been in love with her, and who was a semi-invalid. Whenever she had relations with her husband, she always visualized the form of her first lover. She herself was short, dark and petite. Her husband, a blood relation, was similar in type to herself, and a weed into the bargain. But her three sons were tall, upstanding blonde men of the Nordic type, bearing a strong resemblance to the dead man. The truth of this story was vouched for to me by a friend of the family. I have no personally two alleged changelings. The male had the pointed ears of Pan, and if anyone was ever a son of the devil, he was. The female was a curious and fascinating creature, essentially non-human, and when her child was born it came into the world with no more trouble than a kitten. Both these beings were conceived when their mothers were under the influence of drink, and both of them were characterized by a marked callousness, which in one case developed into deliberate cruelty. Although very peculiar to look at, neither of them was in the least defective, both being, in fact, possessed of considerably more than the average share of brains. Anyone who has any knowledge of the esoteric aspect of sex knows that union is as much etheric as physical. It is this fact which constitutes the real difference between normal union and self-abuse, and explains why the former is vitalizing and harmonizing, and the latter is exhausting and nerve-wrecking. May we not conceive it possible for anyone who can project the etheric body, or a being whose densest vehicle is etheric, to play a part in unions under certain conditions? And if we accept the theory of mediumship, or of obsession, which is a pathological form of mediumship, what shall we say concerning the possibility of a union while one or other of the partners is under control? What member of soul might come through into incarnation under such conditions? Medieval tradition recognized two classes of demons which invade sleep, and called them incubi and succubi. These were held to be responsible for lascivious dreams. Modern psychology discounts their services and looks nearer home. The psychic, however, is of the opinion that there is something in the old belief, and that the lustful imaginings of men's hearts, and women's too, for that matter, do indeed produce artificial elementals according to the method described in a previous chapter, and that these elementals are something more than subjective images, and have an objective etheric existence and play their part in the genesis of certain experiences. For instance, a person may have dreams and fantasies of a lascivious nature, and these may give rise to their characteristic thought forms. These thought forms, now existing independently of the mind that originally conceived them, and being in the aura of that person, give him suggestion just as any other thought forms projected telepathically from the mind of another person might do. We little realize the extent to which we give ourselves telepathic suggestion by means of extruded thought forms. We are, in fact, ensphed by our own atmospheres, emanated by ourselves. I remember being told as a child that if a bird cage were hung immediately under the canopy of an old, fashioned four-poster bed, the bird would be found dead in the morning, poisoned by the carbonic acid gas exhaled by the sleeper lying below. We little realize the extent to which we are psychically poisoned by our own emanations of unguarded and unpurified thoughts. It is well known that orgasm takes place in dreams, accompanied by appropriate dream pictures. The ancients believed that such an experience was due to the action of demons. Moderns believe it to be due to physical tension. It is not so generally known that there are people, both male and female, who can produce the same reaction at will solely by means of day dreams. May we not ask ourselves whether it cannot also be produced by means of telepathic suggestion, and whether this may not have played a part in the operations of many covens? There is another curious phase of this aspect of the left-hand path, which was brought to my knowledge through a case which came into my hands. A young girl, simple-minded and unsophisticated, living a very isolated life with a widowed mother, went to consult a well-known psychic, whom we will call Mr. X in the circle in which both Miss Y and Mr. X moved. There was another, and prominent figure, whom we will call Mr. Z, who had a reputation for a knowledge of magic. Mr. X told Miss Y that he had read the records of her past lives, and that there was a karmic tie between herself and Mr. Z, and that she could help him in his work by pouring out upon him her love and magnetism. She was instructed to meditate upon Mr. Z every night as she lay in bed, until she fell asleep. This poor girl, lonely and unsuspicious, gave herself up unreservedly to this task. Presently, however, she began to grow uneasy. Her common sense asserted itself, for she found the meditations she was required to perform were having a very disturbing effect upon her. But Mr. X allayed her fears and recalled her to her allegiance by assuring her that he had looked into the future and seen that eventually Mr. Z would marry her. By now she had upon her hands a heart-breaking love affair which was making her very unhappy and unfitting her for work. A number of letters upon the subject were exchanged between Miss Y and Mr. X, which I have seen. I did my best to persuade her to drop the whole affair. Mr. X succeeded in persuading her to go on with it, playing upon her feelings and telling her how terrible would be the plight of Mr. Z if she withdrew her psychic support, and renewing his assurance of a karmic tie which would result in an ultimate marriage if she were faithful. Pitifully distressed and bewildered, betook herself to certain of the leaders of the organization to which all three of them belonged. These people seconded my advice that she should discontinue these practices, but persuaded her to surrender the very compromising letters which were in her possession. Having secured these, they declared that the whole transaction was imagination on her part, and instead of turning this choice pair of scoundrels out of their ranks, let them continue to function as usual. This would be a strange enough case if it were an isolated one, but it is not. Another woman came to me about this time in a state bordering on insanity, and told me that she too had been consulting Mr. X, who had told her that she had already received initiation on the inner planes, though she might not be conscious of it, and that her psychic faculties were on the point of opening, a stock remark of his. But if she wanted to make real progress on the path, she must cease to live with her husband, and he, Mr. X, would put her in touch with her astral soul mate. The consequence of this precious advice was to break up her home and send her out of her mind. One day, walking in the park, she met Mr. Z, and declared him to be her astral lover, a statement which Mr. X confirmed, and embellished with the information that Mr. Z was also the master who would initiate her. I tried to persuade her to bring the whole transaction to a summary conclusion and return to her husband, but she replied that she could never do this after the astral experiences she had had. Mr. X re established his influence over her, she left the address at which I had known her, and I have never heard what became of her. Her condition when I last saw her was deplorable, emaciated, wild, eyed and twitching with convulsive movements. Page 67 of 103. Would anyone believe the story of such a woman?